From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it is our reporter roundtable. And if you listen every Friday, you know this is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our region this week. And today, our panel includes Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and our very own Troy Oppy, the host of All Things Considered, right here on Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
All right, let's start with the legislature as we are all waiting for this year's session to wrap up. Clark, it has been a busy week at the State House. I want to begin, though, with property taxes because a lot has happened here. So get us up to date.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. It has been a busy week and things are almost wrapped up at the Idaho State Capitol in Boise. But there was a huge property tax showdown that kind of closed out the legislative session and led to some late drama. I think as you and all the listeners today will know, property taxes have been a huge issue in Idaho with the growth that we've experienced and the increases in property values. A lot of Idahoans are saying that they cannot afford to pay their property taxes. There was a recent Boise State University public policy survey that identified property taxes as one of the top issues for Idahoans. And it's something that Governor Brad Little called for in his State of the State address way back on January 9th. And so property taxes have been this huge issue hanging over the session almost the whole year, even as the bills were debated kind of and discussed behind closed doors before they became public. But what happened was the Idaho House and the Idaho Senate passed a property tax bill, House Bill 292, with a wide measure of bipartisan support, a supermajority of support. But then Governor Brad Little vetoed that property tax bill. He said that he had some concerns about the bill and parts of the bill that really didn't have anything to do with property tax, but were tacked on. He said the original bill as it was written, it would jeopardize bonding and funding for transportation projects. There were some concerns about public defense funding, and the governor expressed a concern that the bill actually eliminates the March election date that local school districts use for bonds and levies. So Governor Little vetoed the bill. That essentially means he rejected the bill. Then the Idaho legislature came back to town this week, and one by one, the Idaho House and Idaho Senate voted to override the bill and pass it into law, the governor's veto notwithstanding. It's actually the first time, I think, since 2007 that the Idaho legislature, that both chambers have overridden a gubernatorial veto. So it was a significant showdown, a significant debate this year. The legislature did make a fix. They did make a fix that was intended to protect the bond payments for transportation funding projects and to clear up the public defense spending issues. The governor said he was happy with those fixes and actually welcomed the override. But one thing that did not get fixed was that March election date. So that's going away. So the two big takeaways: property tax is passed into law. The supporters estimate that it will provide about $355 million in property tax relief in its first year, but it also eliminates that school March election date. So it was a big, dramatic showdown with one of the top issues of the legislative session not really being settled until really yesterday or the day before.
And a turf war mixed in there too, I can jump in. Because the state Senate had attempted to fix all those things that the governor laid out, including that March election date. They gutted a completely separate bill with amendments, passed it, sent it over to the House, and the House said, no, this is not friendly. We're not even going to bother with this. We're just going to do this with the veto override. That was really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. The whole thing just was kind of crazy to watch, to put it bluntly. With that said, I mean, Clark, the legislature was supposed to have or expected to have already been wrapped up. Are we potentially wrapping up today? What's it look like?
Yeah, you're exactly right. The original target date was last Friday. It was March 24th. Legislators missed that goal. The Medicaid budget, the school's budgets hadn't been set by last week. And the setting the state budget is really the one thing the Idaho legislature is required to do by the Idaho Constitution. We see hundreds of bills every year. Some make it, some don't. But the only thing they're really required to do is set a balanced budget for the upcoming year. And that kicks in July 1. And so they missed their original target. The latest is both chambers are at ease. The Idaho House and Idaho Senate are at ease right now. And what we're expecting to happen is the legislature will finish its business, essentially wrap up its business for the year later today at the Idaho State Capitol in downtown Boise. And then they're going to go at recess until Thursday of next week. And so what that's going to do is allow them to take a break and sit back and see if Governor Little vetoes any of the remaining, you know, dozens of bills that have been sent his way. That gives the legislature the ability to come back next Thursday if there are any vetoes and try to override them, as opposed to the alternative of adjourning and shutting down the session for the year today. There's still some procedural moves, some still waiting around on the House and Senate floor that's going to happen. I think we'll still be there a few more hours this afternoon, but do expect them to essentially wrap up their business for the year today, go home, take a recess, and then come back Thursday to see if there's any vetoes waiting for them, potentially act on those vetoes. And then we do expect them to officially adjourn the session for the year, probably next Thursday. And the term is adjourn sine die. That's the term that they use to mean that they're going to adjourn without setting another day to reconvene. That's the Latin term they use. And everybody gets all excited when they hear about that, because it means the legislative session is over for the year.
Finally over after
82 days and counting. So that's the plan. Things do change quickly sometimes with the legislature, and a veto can throw a wrinkle in all of that. But that's the plan. Wrap it up today, come back next Thursday and deal with any loose ends, and then officially shut it down. It's the plan.
So, Brian, I want to bring you into the conversation, because your editorial board wrote a very interesting article recently in regards to some bills that are on Governor Little's desk right now, waiting to see if he will veto these or not. So I first want to discuss House Bill 71. This is about gender-affirming care for transgender children, frankly, making it a felony if a physician gives this type of care, even something like a puberty blocker. So, Brian, we are waiting to see if Governor Little does anything in regards to this. And in your article, can you talk a little bit about how you kind of looked back to what Governor Little did last year before the fall of Roe v. Wade in terms of abortion here in the state?
Sure. Yeah. So folks might remember that in March of last year, Little signed Senate Bills 1309 and 1358. One of those is generally called the total abortion ban, or the abortion trigger law. And the other is often referred to as the abortion bounty law. That's the one that allows people to sue abortion providers. And when Little signed these, he was quite clear that they were deeply flawed. He said that the bounty law was probably unconstitutional. He said that it would probably be used by states like California to target the Second Amendment. You know, that same mechanism, and he was right about that. California did attempt that, but that has already been ruled unconstitutional. And he also pointed out that there were deep flaws in the trigger law that would make the exceptions for rape and incest inaccessible in practice, because you couldn't get a police report. That was also correct, because the follow-up legislation this year is meant to fix that, to make it easier for a woman who's reported that she's been raped or that incest has occurred to obtain a police report so that a legal abortion can be obtained. But Little signed these bills nonetheless. And so what I was arguing is the flaws in this year's legislation are just as clear. And so my argument is, this time Little shouldn't just say the right thing. He should do the right thing. He should veto these bills.
Well, right. And what are we, but he doesn't necessarily have to veto it, right? He could just not do anything and it will go into law.
Right. He could let it become law without his signature. That's one option. He could sign them. But So both of those are open possibilities. But you know, my argument is that he ought to veto them. It's possible that the legislature could override a veto, as they did with the property tax bill. Mm-hmm. But they have a history of losing some votes when it comes back to attempt a veto override.
Well, what's interesting to me about this, Brian, in particular House Bill 71 with making gender-affirming care for minors a felony, is that we had legislators all during the pandemic who were very adamant that you know, my child, my choice, right? This is you. It's parental rights. We see that with faith healing practices in this state. You know, it goes on and on about parents being allowed to make choices for their children. However, there is a culture war going on, not just in Idaho, but across the country, coming from Republicans, frankly, who have always very much championed the parent and a parent's ability to make choices for their children. And this feels like the exact opposite. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, it certainly does. This is coming from the national religious right. Similar bills have been introduced in state houses around the country. Many of them have passed. An interesting point of comparison would be Idaho's faith healing exemption. So if a child has pneumonia, Idaho law provides that parent is allowed to simply pray, not provide them any medical care. And a lot of Idaho children have died because of that. But that's a right that Idaho protects. By contrast, for a transgender child who has gone through a long course of counseling with their parents, with doctors, if this law is signed, there's no ability to even seek puberty blockers, which are generally mm-hmm. considered reversible and are sort of like hitting the pause button to give them more time to make a final decision about what kind of care they want to pursue. That would not be a protected right.
And we should note that puberty blockers are used on children who are not transgender. There are children who go into puberty very early, and doctors prescribe this. It's the exact same thing. And it slows things down. So just wanted to make that clarification. I do want to leave the legislature.
That's right.
Yeah, I do want to leave the legislature for a moment. We will come back to it. There's a lot more to get to. But Don, I want to talk with you and talk a little bit about travel. In particular, travel for one Boise City employee. Now, normally, this would not be newsworthy, Don. But I think it's fair to say the city of Boise has a bit of a complicated and questionable history when it comes to travel expenses.
Yeah, we put a particular focus on travel expense and travel policies in the city of Boise here at Boise Dev. And some of that is born out of the fact that I'm old. And when I was not old and young, I covered the news surrounding former Mayor Brent Coles at Boise City mm-hmm. Hall and a series of trips that were taken on the taxpayer dime, including to Broadway shows, a historical Mormon site, a what would it even be called? The play, we'll just say to Key West, Florida, to go to an adult club and other things.
Good way to put it.
Yeah. current council member Lucy Willits, at Tuesday's meeting, which looked to be boring, I actually showed up because I wanted to ask council members about something else. I didn't get to do that. But she asked to take one of the city's requests for travel off of the what's called the consent agenda, which is sort of the list of things he thinks is routine. Ever since the Coles administration and the former mayor left office and then was later imprisoned, the council has made a policy of putting any travel requests in the city on the council agenda, and that includes international travel. The Boise Library had requested funds for a library employee to travel to a conference in Denmark this May called Next Library. That draws about 350 librarians from 96 countries around the world. And The expense was for about $5,500, which is, I think, fairly significant. Mm-hmm. The argument from Councilmember Willits was, this is a lot, first of all, and second of all, it's a long way. And so we went back and I researched all of the council agendas since Councilmember Willits joined the council in January of last year, and checked. And there was only one travel request that was for more money, and that was for former council president Elaine Clegg to travel to Washington, D.C. for the League of Cities. Councilmember Willits had voted to approve that, and I actually asked her about it, and she told me, in essence, that that was something that the city had had agreed to do. It was part of Councilmember Clegg's service on that body, and so she thought that was appropriate. There wasn't a lot of other international travel. Oddly enough, there was another request for international travel on the council agenda that same day to send Zoo Boise director Gene Peacock, yes, that's his real name, to Mozambique, South Africa. But that cost was not to be borne by the taxpayers. The city still has to approve it. So Councilmember Willits brought this up and said she thinks that it was too much and too far is essentially what she told me after the meeting. The council ultimately voted to approve this. Council President Holly Wooding said that this is one of the best in class library conferences and is essential for what she called librarians of the caliber of Boise City. Councilmember Patrick Bagent said he didn't really recall a lot of library travel. And even though this was a large single request, he thought it was important and not really much more than other departments spend on the whole. And so just a little bit of kind of interesting, people are watching the dollars still at City Hall 20 years later. And I know Councilmember Willits has actually brought up remembering being a citizen in Boise during the Coles issues and is just trying to put a watchful eye on the taxpayers' dollars.
Which is fair, honestly, especially I think when we look at the history, as you said, Don, you and I both covered that 20 years ago.
Yeah, and this is abnormal. Most cities don't do this. They don't put all the travel requests up for a vote, and they happen, I would say, much more quietly. And so the city of Boise is an outlier, and that is born out of scandal.
Right, absolutely. So Troy, some big news out at the city of Eagle. We've been waiting to find out if the city will or will not annex Avamore, and they made a decision.
They did. The city council voted 3-1 last night to annex Avamore into the city of Eagle. This, of course, comes after years of debate, and that's been the plan all along for the developers of Avamore to become part of the city of Eagle, but not without controversy and several moments of tense public meetings in recent months. Mm-hmm. Councilors last night kind of put a fine point on everything, going over the details like who's going to manage the natural trails in the area? How are they going to fund law enforcement and cover gaps in spending as Avamore comes under city control? But the focal point for everybody in favor was just simply getting control of that subdivision. It's built out around maybe a little more than 10% of its planned full development. That's going to be close to 8,800 homes 30, 40 years from now. So getting control of that land and the open space that's planned along with it was seemingly a key factor for councilors making this decision. Brad Pike was the lone dissenting vote on the council. Mm-hmm. He said he's not opposed to annexing Avamore, but his vote was really aligned with the findings of the city's Planning and Zoning Commission, which was not a no, but a not right now. We need to have more information and maybe a more firm plan for what providing city services is going to look like, you know, as they work with homes in parts of three different counties as Avamore grows. And I want to toss the potato over to Dawn because Margaret Carmel's done some excellent reporting as this has gone along on the estimates of costs and revenue that are going to be provided by that tax base where you have kind of conflicting estimates, one showing that it's going to cost the city millions of dollars over the long term and the developer saying, no, it's going to be revenue neutral. Don?
Yeah, and that is quite the task because I don't have that story pulled up. But essentially, essentially what happened is the city paid for consultants. Avamore paid for consultants. The numbers didn't match, and quite spectacularly. The Avamore developer has said that there are some flaws in the City of Eagle's approach, but folks in Eagle aren't sure they believe it, I think is fair to say. Tossing the hot potato to somebody who's not here, Rachel Spacek at the Idaho Statesman. The photo right on the front page of the Statesman's coverage of this the other day showed people with signs worrying about insolvency for the City of Eagle. The point is a bit moot for right now, although it is something I think we're all going to watch to see really what the fiscal impact of the City of Eagle is long term. And we don't know. One of the things I think that came up, and forgive me if Troy, if you mentioned this, but there was a stabbing near Avamore this week, and that was alluded to in the testimony on or in the closing arguments earlier this week, because public safety is a big issue at Avamore because it's quite a ways from the bulk, the nucleus downtown Eagle.
Well, yeah, and Councilor Piper referred
to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to bring that up because, I mean, people need to understand that the City of Eagle to Avamore is almost 9 miles. I mean, it's a drive time of without traffic of about 13 minutes, right? So I know, Don, we've talked about this briefly on the show before. I mean, when you look at things like emergency services, right? Fire, police, that's a long time and a long stretch of road to get to in an emergency situation, which we saw this week.
It is, and it sprawls out over three counties. It's not just Ada County, but Boise and Gem County, and people drive by there and go, oh, there's a lot of houses out there. And I will say, just wait, there's gonna be a lot more houses out there. You know, I think the other thing that's key to watch here is what the political implications will be of this going forward too. We're in an election year and, Mayor Pierce and, I believe two of the council members are going to be on the ballot. And so people in Eagle are going to have a chance to fairly quickly say if they think that the leaders made the right decision.
Yeah, I think you're accurate on that. So Clark, let's head back to the legislature because as we mentioned, still a lot going on. We have seen across the country, Clark, a mission to ban drag performers and performances. This is not just an Idaho thing. In fact, earlier this week, a bill passed in the state of Tennessee to do just that. There has been a similar bill in Idaho. There has been testimony about it. But here we are with the session winding down, basically going into recess until next Thursday. And I am making the assumption that this bill won't go through. And I think a lot of people may be surprised by that.
Yeah, Jimmy, you're exactly right. That's what it looks like. It looks like House Bill 265 is dead for the year. Mia Maldonado, the new reporter for the Idaho Capital Sun, had a story about that for us yesterday, and I covered the bill when it was in its hearing form and when it was introduced earlier this session. But yeah, this is something that similar bills have been introduced in state houses across the country. The Idaho Family Policy Center, a conservative Christian organization, wrote this bill and pushed this bill after pride events and drag shows that took place in Coeur d'Alene and in Boise last year. The Idaho Family Policy Center vowed to write these bills banning public drag shows, and they did. They came forward with House Bill 265 earlier this year. I think I was on Idaho Matters maybe about 6 weeks ago talking about this bill at one point, but it targeted public performances that included any type of what the bill described as sexual conduct. And it did a couple of different things. It was going to ban minors from attending any public performances that included sexual conduct, as it was broadly described in the bill. It also would have banned these drag performances at any kind of publicly owned venue, including a city or a state park, including a city, state, or municipally owned performing arts center. But that bill is dead for the year. It had actually passed the Idaho House, but earlier this week we learned that the Idaho Senate was not going to be taking up that bill and was not going to the advancing it. They were concerned about the definition and it being so broad. They were also concerned about, it's called a private cause of action, and we've seen this in a number of bills this year in the Idaho legislature and all across the country, but it's a section of the bill that would have given people the authority to sue if they felt that a section of this bill was violated. So the bill is dead for this year. It's not going to pass this session, but I don't think that the Idaho Family Policy Center and some of the folks that supported the bill are going anywhere, and so I think it will come up in future legislative sessions. But yeah, that's the latest. It's a bill that I know that a lot of people had come out to testify about. And there were a lot of concerns, frankly, that although this bill, even the organizers were clear that this bill was designed to target drag shows. A lot of people were concerned that, A, they misrepresented what drag shows are and are not, and the art of a drag show. But they were also concerned that this bill could have had a huge chilling effect and could have jeopardized any kind of live performing arts show or performance in the state of Idaho because that definition of sexual conduct was so broad. Could that include dancers at a pop concert? You know, and so there are all kinds of legal questions about what this bill would do, as well as concerns that it had misrepresented what drag and drag shows and pride events are about. But it does look like House Bill 265 is dead, will not be advancing in the session in the Idaho Senate, and that's enough to kill it for this year. So I know a lot of people were watching that bill closely, and just so much is happening as we wind down the session that it's hard to keep track of things individually. So I'm glad we were able to spend a couple of minutes and talk about what the latest is for that bill there.
Well, and I think it's interesting, Clark, you know, you bring up the broadness of that bill, right? Because I know here on this program, we have mentioned you take the Idaho Shakespeare Festival, right? You take any Shakespeare performances. I mean, Shakespeare started with only men playing all of the characters and men playing female characters. We still see that to this day, or women playing male characters. That could have a chilling effect on these performances because, I mean, that's drag. That's what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. This came up during a number of the hearings. The people who wrote the bill, the supporters of the bill, said, no, this isn't intended to apply to classic works of literature, such as William Shakespeare, or even, you know, a movie like Mrs. Doubtfire. But opponents and some legal experts said, hold on here, this is so broad that we're not sure. And so there was concern about, would this apply to Idaho Shakespeare Festival? Would this apply to concerts? Would this apply to any kind of theater or public live performance? And so there was a lot of concern about what this would mean for the performing arts community and for touring performing arts shows, whether it's theater, whether it's music, whether it's pride or drag. There was a lot of concern about how would this bill be interpreted? How could this be enforced? Different people have different definitions of sexual conduct. And so it was a lot of concerns about the vagueness and broadness of the bill. But absolutely, any number of performing arts groups were concerned about the chilling effect they described that could have, that could maybe have just impacted that we're just not going to have live performance art in the state of Idaho. That was one of the concerns about this bill because, again, the definition of sexual conduct and how broad that was. So you're absolutely right that those concerns were there for sure.
Troy, you were going to make, I think, a really interesting point about, you know, arts organizations and the true concern that they had about a bill like this being passed.
Yeah, and Clark mentioned this as well. Arts organizations here were deeply concerned about that legislation. And the only real fine period I was going to put on it was that some had gone so far as to hire a lobbyist for the first time in their history. And they were also talking with other organizations in other states about similar legislation that's being tried elsewhere. So that was of deep concern for local arts folks.
And I think it'll be interesting, Troy, to see how other states, I mentioned the state of Tennessee passing a bill similar to this going into law, to see what happens, you know, in the next 6 to 9 months until we come back into session here in Idaho and what happens in regards to that. Because I think sometimes it's like you watch another state to test the waters and then do you come back with a bill?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Clark, Okay, end of session. We've talked about this. What is interesting to me is why in the world would the legislature wait until literally the last minute to do anything in regards to Medicaid funding? I mean, why leave this to the very end of the session to figure out? And what have they figured out?
That's a great question, Jim. And if I think I had the answer, I'd be paid a lot better and have a different position than I do. But we saw so much of that. Big issues being pushed to the very end of the legislative session. Medicaid budget, as you mentioned, property taxes, school budgets and raises for teachers. And so the only guess I would have is that JFAC, that's the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, the legislature's budget committee, got such a slow start this year with new members, a new Speaker of the House who was attempting to push new voting rules in the budget committee. They got a little bit of a slow start, but so often, so many legislative sessions I can remember, the most important things are left to the end. And the Medicaid budget had quite a journey to even get passed over the last 2 days. Initially, it was killed by the Idaho House of Representatives after several Republicans complained about the overall cost, $4.7 billion from all funding sources, the largest budget in state history. But then you had several other legislators who said, listen, in 2018, Idaho voters overwhelmingly voted to expand Medicaid coverage to low-income Idahoans who could not afford their insurance. And so the state of Idaho is obligated to pay the claims that come out of the Medicaid program one way or the other. And so there was a lot, quite frankly, of heated debate and testimony on Wednesday and Thursday of this week at the state capitol about the rewritten Medicaid budget, which after it was killed, they rewrote it. They took $152 million or so off the bottom line in anticipation of Idaho health and welfare officials taking folks off of the Medicaid program who are no longer eligible. But even Republican legislators who were on JFAC were saying, look, the state is obligated to pay these bills, to pay these claims under Medicaid. And so we can cut the Medicaid budget all we want. We can cut it by $1 billion, but we're going to have to come back next year with a supplemental and pay these budget bills. And so I think what ultimately ended up happening is the Medicaid budget passed by one vote out of the Idaho Senate yesterday. It was 18-17. And so narrowly approved. It does fund Medicaid. It does not repeal Medicaid expansion. But there was some concern about what the right level of funding is. And some Republican legislators are anticipating that the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare officials will come in and remove people from the Medicaid rolls who are not eligible for the program. But again, they said Idaho voters expanded Medicaid coverage via a ballot initiative after the Idaho legislature would not act on this. The idea with that was expanding Medicaid to Idahoans who live, I think it's at 138% of the federal poverty level and could not otherwise afford their insurance. And they're saying this is so much of a better deal for the state of Idaho. 66% of the funding comes from the federal government, and having Medicaid available to them is a lot more economical to the state than the alternative. And so it was quite a huge debate, and it only ended up passing by one vote yesterday. But we often see these important discussions left until the very end. It almost feels like they're messing around for the first 2 months or 60 days in session. And then somebody wakes up on March 1st and realizes, oh, my goodness, we have to set the state budget. We have to do property taxes. We have to do this and that and that and the other. And it happens every year almost.
You're totally right. It does. Brian, I want to go back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier today in regards to this article that your editorial board wrote. And these are about some bills that are sitting on Governor Little's desk. Another bill is House Bill 314. Can you tell us about this bill, and your thoughts on it?
Sure thing. So, just pulling that up. The numbers are not okay. That's the library bill. Sorry,
Right. No, totally get it.
Not as good with numbers.
Let me just throw that number out there for you, and then you have to try to remember what it is. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No problem. So this is a rewritten bill. It was sponsored by Senate President Chuck Winder, among others, that attempts to limit what kinds of books can be in libraries and which can be made available to children, which is a bit of a vague term, as has been mm-hmm. discussed elsewhere. It allows a parent to again use a private cause of action, similar to what Clark discussed earlier, to collect $2,500 in a lawsuit if their kids get a book that is deemed to be inappropriate. This is another one that I'm urging Little to veto, because on top of it having this private cause of action, a trustee from Meridian said his advice is, if it passed, would be to immediately revoke all library cards to minors and not allow kids in the library without a parent accompanying them. On top of that, it provides in some cases for books to be physically destroyed. So my thought about that is, you know, we've used the metaphor of book burning for a while with legislation that's come down the pike. Well, this time it's literal. That's pretty disturbing.
So, Troy, get us up to date on what's going on with this cobalt mine near Salmon. It was supposed to be the only mine like this in the United States, but construction has apparently stopped.
Yeah, at this point, the short answer is there's nothing going on. Idaho Cobalt Operation is the official name of this project. It's kind of adjacent to the old Blackbird mine site, Thompson Creek area. Salmon is the closest town of reference there. And they were expecting to come online at full production by later this quarter. They'd kind of begun operations late last year and were finishing their final construction. The company that owns them is Gervois Global. It's an Australian company. And this week they announced the price of cobalt, which is going to be their primary mineral that they're extracting. The price of cobalt is so low that they are pausing their final construction phase. They have laid off around 250 people. And they're going to wait it out until the prices rebound. They do think that will happen as demand increases. This was going to be the United States' only domestic source of cobalt. And, cobalt is a high-temperature alloy that has been used in jet airplanes and jet engines and things like that. But it's also critical to the production of batteries for electric cars. And as those demands increase, as more incentives are provided by government authorities to get people into electric cars and off of fossil fuel cars, they think that demand is going to be there. But for now, it's not. And they have shut down their processes over at ICO.
Okay. Don, the Elkhor Shrine in downtown Boise has new owners. What's going on with that?
Yeah, Andy Scoggin and his firm, Scoggin Capital Investment, purchased the building earlier this month. Scoggin is a former Albertsons executive and an investor in the Treefort Music Festival. He is going to lease the building to Duck Club Presents, which founded the festival. Some nuance here. If you've seen this story somewhere else and you saw where it said Duck Club was buying it, that's because they put out a news release that was in error. They said that they were buying it. They aren't. Scoggin Capital Investment is buying it and is leasing it to Duck Club. And so this is going to become a full-time venue. It's been used for a number of years for Treefort and other shows that mm-hmm. the Treefort organizers have put on. Now that will be its primary purpose. The Shriners, for their part, decided a couple of years ago to sell the building. They've seen declines in membership. There was concern about lack of parking and the age of the building. It dates to 1914. Harry W. Morrison, the co-founder of Morrison Knudsen, was involved in the construction of this building, and it's stood the test of time, still standing here more than 100 years later, and will continue. Scoggin says they have no plans to redevelop the building, although they do look to make some improvements. People in our social comments tell me that the women's bathroom is really interesting, but nobody wants to say why. So if you can clue me in, that'd be great. So it's going to be kind of an interesting time. That building is surrounded by some new projects. There were other bidders to the Shriners to purchase the building, but Scoggin came in with the best offer.
And it, you know, it'll be interesting to see what other, I think, probably performances and things like that come through. Because, you know, Treefort's only once a year. And speaking of Treefort, Don, I want to ask you another thing. And this is in regards to the main stage of Treefort. For the first time, it was at Julia Davis Park in downtown Boise. The turf got fairly damaged. So who's going to fix this? Or I would assume maybe have to replace all of this.
Yeah, so I just disconnected, but I heard the beginning of what you said. I think you're asking about the mud at the park. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, at Julia Davis Park, because this was the first time that they've ever had the main stage in Julia Davis Park, right?
They did. And so Treefort has been kind of the parking lot festival the last few years, using some of the empty parking lots in downtown Boise that are quickly not becoming empty anymore. And so they had to look for a new place to go. That place was Julia Davis Park. My reporter, Margaret Carmel, who was at the festival along with my reporter, Autumn Robertson, noticed that it was a muddy mess. And so Autumn reached out to Treefort to ask, hey, what's up with that? They are going to bear the costs of fixing and repairing the turf. We also checked in with Boise Parks and Rec, the City of Boise agency that manages the park. And they say they don't actually have an estimate on the damage. And we couldn't get an answer on if it was better or worse than expected. I think you can imagine because of the wet weather, things might have been a little less in a little less good of shape as they had hoped because of all the rain and the grapple that was falling during the festival. It's interesting because about a decade ago in 2012, the city actually sued, according to the Idaho Statesman at the time, a beer festival. Yeah, for beating up the turf at Ann Morrison.
Don, I was going to bring that up because that's why that beer fest never, one of the reasons why that beer fest never returned to Boise Park.
Yeah, done by the Breforia organizers and a traveling group, and it went away. And so, you know, I don't think that's going to be the issue with Treefort. Treefort has been pretty forthcoming and saying, yeah, we're going to take care of this, but we are going to have our eye on just how much it's going to cost. Because I understand it's pretty messy over there. I haven't seen it, but I'm told it's kind of a mess.
Well, that'll be interesting to see if the main stage comes back there next year, right? Because do you want to spend every year replacing the turf that you damaged? So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It is. I want to thank all of you for spending your noon hour with us on this Friday. Much appreciated. We've been talking with Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and our very own Troy Oppie, the host of All Things Considered on Boise State Public Radio News. Have a good weekend, everyone. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jimma. Thank you. Fun.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jimma Gaudet. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.